Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hello, I'm Associate Professor Clifford Lewis, and in this month's episode, we'll be talking about women in corporate leadership. We've all heard about how women are underpaid in the workforce, but this disparity also continues in senior positions women might take on within corporate Australia. A report at the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet in 2003 suggested that 22.3% of CEOs in Australia are women. That's only one in five, approximately. While 34% of board members are women, only 18% of board chairs are women. And this shows the difference between being invited to sit at the table versus being invited to lead the table. This disparity even continues in female-dominated industries, where men are more likely to occupy senior positions. So in this month's episode, I'll be joined by two guests to discuss why this is the case and hopefully what can be done to change this. I'm joined by Claire Wright today, who is a DECRA Fellow at UTS. Claire, would you like to start off by telling us a little bit about your research?
Sure. So I am a specialist in diversity and inclusion, specifically looking at women in corporate leadership. Yeah, so a lot of the, I suppose, barriers to women in leadership up until a certain point was that they weren't necessarily working in the areas that we would expect corporate leaders to work in. So if you're a CEO, or if you're a board member, or if you're an executive, you probably need to have professional training in accounting, law, management, those sorts of things. You probably then need to have an uninterrupted career and have the ability to progress from the entry level all the way to your particular leadership role. And then you might progress to the CEO job and then to board roles from that. So until, you know, the 1960s, women had to, in lots of different professions, women had to resign upon marriage. They were trained in lots of different types of professions, but they were not trained as accountants or lawyers or managers, the sorts of things that corporations would want for their leadership team. Women were, prevented from entering the relevant professions. They were prevented from progressing in the workforce in the way that men were. And so that was, you know, it's what I call a pipeline issue. There wasn't a pipeline of relevant women with the right experience, the right education in order to have these leadership roles. And of course, this changed primarily with second wave feminism. So from the 1970s, feminists fought to allow women to be trained in a wider variety of professions. And all of these things really helped develop that pipeline of potential corporate leaders. So women that were, at least had the basic qualifications and experience to be able to be appointed to leadership roles.
See, it's fascinating what you're saying to me, because it sounds like women just didn't have the qualifications for the role. And arguably, sometimes men without qualifications for roles also get hired.
Of course.
So is there also a social element that you find in that context that has played a role in keeping women away?
Of course. And so if qualifications were the only thing that mattered, you know, we would have equal numbers of men and women, and we would have had so for decades. And so there is, of course, these attitudinal issues as well. So women kind of entered the right sort of professions from the 1970s, but it's taken a really, really long time for any progress to be made. And so then the next battle becomes an attitudinal one of actually making sure that people view women differently, or, you know, that they accepting that women are as capable as men, which at a certain time was up for debate. The battle, I suppose, has been fought on two fronts, both the demographic changes to women's education and work, but also trying to change the minds of the people in power. And that's been quite a recent phenomenon. So the what I call the catalyst for change, after the pipeline has been developed, you need then a catalyst for change. And that has been from around 2010. So a really, really recent phenomenon, at least over the horizon that I tend to look at.
Definitely. And how far have we come? Because you talk about, winning that battle of qualifications and social norms. Has much actually changed, or are we seeing things which are performative? Because yes, of course, government bodies can challenge things, but just because they do doesn't mean society actually changes.
Of course, of course. And, you know, in some ways there has been really big strides, right? So we went from zero women in leadership in the early 1980s to over 35% of women in corporate leadership today. So that's like, you know, if you look at over long enough horizon, that's a really big change, at least in the demographics of the leadership suite of major Australian companies. There are also some problems with, do women have comparable levels of influence? So women are in leadership, but they're not the chair of the board, they're not the CEO, they're more likely to be the executive in charge of human resources or in charge of marketing or in charge of, you know, things that are not generally pipelines to the CEO position. So there's problems with our women in comparable levels of influence in these leadership teams. And then, of course, there's big problems with intersectional matters. So while we do have a lot of women in leadership, they tend to be a very narrow profile. So they tend to be white, they tend to be straight, they tend to be wealthy, they tend to be from the city. And so I always say that, you know, women in leadership often have more in common with men in leadership than they do with other women.
And going back to that, you know, arguably people of color as well, you know, being underrepresented, people of diverse sexual orientations. One of the things that I've seen in my work, Claire, which is on LGBT inclusion, is this notion of confidence, right? A lot of LGBT people of color just don't feel confident or welcome in mainstream LGBT space. And I'm wondering how that plays out here, because as you said, you know, there is a certain type of women that people that's now, and I use the word allowed quite deliberately, certain type of woman that's allowed in the boardroom. How can other women be supported in that context to get there? Have you had any thoughts about what needs to change?
So sort of to your point about confidence, yeah, I think that one of the problems with women in leadership and also everyone in leadership that, you know, isn't a straight white 60-year-old man is confidence. But also it's understandable that they don't have confidence, because where would they have gotten that confidence from? If you're never represented in a space, then of course you're not going to feel confident. And especially if you're the only woman in a room, how are you going to feel safe enough to speak up in a meeting or in a, you know, in an issue that matters to you? Or if you're the only non-white person in a company, the only non-white person in a particular leadership team, of course you're going to lack confidence. And so the solutions to these things have often been developed at the individual level. So, you know, all of this research comes out and they say, okay, women lack confidence in leadership. We should probably teach them how to be confident, rather than going, what are we doing as a society to not make them confident? What are we doing as a company to not make them confident? And so I suppose there are lots of things at the individual level that we can do. And in some ways that's easier, like, you know, workshops and confidence building things and mentorship schemes or whatever. But I suppose the perspective that I take is that this is bigger than fixing one particular woman or a group of women who attend your workshop. This is about taking, essentially trying to dismantle the way that we have viewed merit, the way that we have viewed leadership capabilities, the way that we have viewed corporate leadership more generally, in order to be more inclusive for everyone, not just for the people who may have attended a particular workshop and so on.
And one of the other things as well that I'm hearing, which is women get on boards because they're women, and it's not, you know, I don't know if you've ever come across this narrative, but it's, well, what does she know? She's on a board, so she's got the position because she's a female, which is also so corrosive to any DEI initiative.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things that the kind of the tokenism argument is brings up is that, oh, well, she must have only received that position because she's a woman. Does she actually have the qualifications to be there? Does she actually have the track record and so on? And there's usually a bit of silence when we ask that of men. We don't necessarily wonder if a man has received his position purely on his own merit. We don't even ask the question. We just assume that he has the relevant qualifications, we have, he has the relevant experience. And so there's it's almost like even making the tokenism argument is assuming she doesn't have the qualifications, that assuming that of the two options, either she got the position because she's a woman or she got the position because she's qualified. We're almost assuming tokenism when we're asking that particular question. And so in terms of what needs to change, I don't know, to be honest with you. It is a very complicated issue. And this is why we often do focus on these individual things of like, okay, how do we implement these initiatives, these things? We often move around the edges of the issue rather than attacking the core issue, because the core issue is to actually reformulate the way that we think about merit and the way that we think about achievement.
And I think that's really the fix, really. We need a considered approach. We can't just have practices without much consideration. I was reading the notorious RBG, and I'm going to butcher this quote, but she says something about, you know, it's not about having one woman in the space to advocate for women. It's about having many women in the space so the space can change. I've definitely butchered that quote. But how do we then encourage young women today? For our young listeners out there, what would you advise them about corporate leadership? And where they can start. And there might also be young scholars who are interested in your field of research.
Yeah, and I think that the biggest thing is you can't be what you can't see. So I think that finding places to work where you have people that you can look up to, and that doesn't necessarily mean women, because of course we're all intersectional. And so the person that you might most identify with may or may not be a woman, but someone that you can see that has done the things that you want to do. And if there is a company that you're thinking about working for that doesn't have anyone who looks like you or has similar interests to you, then it might not be the right company for you, because it's unlikely that they're going to support your career in the way that a company with a proven track record of supporting people like you has. So I think taking that very seriously is a big piece of advice, that as an employee you do have some say as to you know, choosing your career and choosing where you choose to invest your time. And I think that for scholars who are looking into this area, my biggest piece of advice is to not minimize the complexity of this problem. Sometimes as researchers, we want to write our little paper, and we want to, you know, do a study on a very discrete thing, and there's the value of that. But by simplifying this issue is, okay, well, we've run some confidence building workshops and it's increased confidence amongst women in leadership by so many points. There's almost a simplification of how difficult this is to change and how long-term we have to think and how we have to, as you say, have a considered approach. And so thinking both in terms of the complexity of the situation, but also the intersectionality of the situation, that women are not just one thing, I think would be my recommendation for how to approach this issue in a very serious way.
Thank you for engaging in this conversation with me today.
Thank you so much. It's been really nice.
I'm now joined by Jackie Johnson, who's held several board positions across Australia and who's now doing a PhD looking at this very topic. Jackie, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Cliff, and thank you for allowing me to join you today. Yeah, if I go way back, you know, I was an immigrant at the age of six, coming from Liverpool, England, and came from a family, was very much working class. And so setting ourselves up in Australia, my father believes Australia gives great opportunities for education, and there was no debate that I had to go to university. And then roll forward, I started my career as an occupational therapist and then as a safety scientist working with large companies like Ford, BHP, a lot of hard industry. And then I was appointed to the WorkCover board in the 90s, looking at how do we promote safety amongst workplaces and also develop a fair workers' compensation system. And at the same time, I was then working for a large insurer. And then I moved into insurance in an executive role, looking at joint ventures between banks and insurers to make sure people who have property can get insurance and get cover, and which is a very important thing when you've got increasing risk of weather events happening that can cause quite significant damage for business and for households. Roll forward my career as an executive in an insurance company. I was CEO of Insurance Australia Group in New Zealand at the time the earthquakes happened, which makes you really reflect on your own leadership. And I was managing director of our board in New Zealand as well. And then I was president of the Insurance Council, which is like a chair role of the board of the Insurance Council. And when you're seeing so many communities hurting after such an awful event that kept going for several years with a lot of things that needed to be sorted out in terms of rebuilding back safely, it really caused me to reflect on my own leadership and why I did what I was doing. I came back to Australia in 2016, and at that time I was a group executive within the company, but also I was the co-chair of United Nations Financial Initiative to make sure capital can flow to the right places for social and environmental goals. So it's not just about the money a company makes, but how the money is made. But I always wanted to do my PhD. And so I kept trying to retire. By 2019, I made the decision that I definitely was going to retire that year and do my PhD, which I started in 2020, a notable year, given I was on campus once before COVID hit. But I'm also a non-executive director of a mutual bank, which gives me another type of experience, because you're then there for a not-for-profit type bank, but really thinking about the way lending has to happen to get people into housing, get people into personal lending or green loans. And throughout the time, I've also been a commissioner for the New South Wales government for the Illawarra Shoalhaven for 18 months. So lots of wide different experiences, Cliff, that really makes you reflect on your own leadership, community and environment.
Wow. Like, I didn't know you were involved with three quarters of those things. And it's always amazing to hear that journey. Well, so you've been through the trap, so to speak. You've risen up in your rank, in your careers, amongst ranks. How was it like being a female in those roles? I just can't imagine how it would have been coming to the position you have as a female. And I mean this with a lot of respect and love.
Thanks, Cliff. And getting to know you, I know you do take it with care as you're asking that question. I mean, it shows my age. I mean, we're talking, my career started in the hospital system in the 80s, and I found as much sexism in that career as I did when I then was on the shop floor in Ford Motor Company at Homebush, for example, or down in their Melbourne plant in Broadmeadows. But it's challenging. I mean, I remember when I was at Ford Consulting, and in a car industry, you get the opportunity to really retool the plant and to think about safety every time you're thinking about the next model car. If you think about the engineers in the 80s all coming from Detroit, and they just wanted to get the car launched. They didn't want someone who would challenge them. And particularly, there were very few females in senior positions back then as well. And I remember one time a very senior person said to me, "You're not a car man. Why are you interfering? You're thinking strike two, you know, not from the car industry, and I'm not a male." And you had to really just think about your presence and really think about how you were able to understand their needs, but know what you were there to do and what the objective. And for me, it was about future safety of people who are working, building the cars. But respecting that all these people had knowledge about how cars were to be built and designed, but making sure that there was a meeting of objectives. And sometimes it was a little scary because you had to get your voice heard and you had to be brave, but not imitate some of the masculine qualities that you didn't quite like yourself when you saw that in leadership either.
So you've obviously done it. And, you know, but we still don't see many other women in these roles. Like, I think a stat that I was reading about today was something around 12 or 13% of chairs of these boards are actually women. And about a third members of these boards are women across Australia. What's prevented or what's stopping more women from getting into this? It's 2024, for goodness sake.
It's a good point, Cliff. And it's something I talked to my daughter, who's obviously now got her own professional career as well, about. I think it's two parts of a problem. I think society has to change their view about the male role model too. And so my husband and I reversed roles, enabling me to take the main breadwinner and the main roles. And he's a nurse by background, and he worked part-time, and he wanted to be the main home giver. And so we had to adjust to that. And in the 80s, people thought it was because he couldn't get a job. And so, no, that was a very clear choice. So I think there needs to be a bigger group of discussions that occur to say, what's the role of men in society and how can men have choice too? Because that's the other half of the challenge about freeing up so women can have their career path. And then it becomes a discussion about the roles you play in society as well as your professional career. Times it's not easy because you are making have to choices. I don't say you can have it all. There's times you do have to trade off and when you're feeling tired. What I will say is that education is not the barrier now. You know, when you look at graduates in finance, law, all the professions that tend to go to good governance roles, there are a lot of females graduating and they're very capable. And so I think we have to address what is it about career pathways that are getting in the way, but what is it about society that's getting in the way that's not enabling everyone to have their choice that then gets more females in these roles. But I also think as females, we have to back ourselves. I myself have been in positions where I haven't applied for the roles and then I've had to be tapped on the shoulder, would you apply? And you're there going, oh, I don't have this, I don't have that. And then this person who's trying to get me to apply is saying, but think about all the things you do have. And I think it's a little different what I've seen of my male colleagues will go, well, I've got about 50 to 60% of what they need. I'll give it a shot. So I've changed my view about, I now think about opportunities of, will I learn something new? Can I contribute? And do I have a lot of respect for the people I'd be working with? And if all three things satisfy, I take a deep breath and I go for it.
And I think that's really about it, right? Like about not holding yourselves back in a way too. We were talking also earlier about this idea about how women on boards actually help the organization, because quite often it can be seen as a, you know, a DEI initiative, but it's really not a philanthropic initiative, right? There is a lot more that the organization gets from that process as well. What's your experience been like around that, Jackie?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a very big debate. You know, there's a lot of people that are against targets and quotas. I myself at times haven't thought quotas are helpful. I think what it does is it forces a broader perspective of where you can actually recruit from, because if you've got a target for a particular skill set, then you're more likely to actually have to look broader. My own research is quite interesting because I've looked at the largest 200 companies listed on Australia Stock Exchange and looked at how they're partnering to look at social and environmental goals, particularly under the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And if I look at the companies that are more highly stakeholder orientated and delivering better value, they look like they've got a better mix, over 40% of females on their board. But when you unpack it, what those females are bringing to the board table are different skills and experiences. And so they're bringing a different view of stakeholders to the board table, which helps with broader decisions. And I've seen that in my own career. And so I think as we broaden where we recruit from, you then start to get more diverse opinions around the board table. And that strengthens governance, because the question is, what are we doing to help our customers, our employees, our communities?
So it really shakes up that focus from the old school profit motive sort of mindset to being a bit more of a social mindset, which is really what, you know, I think more and more so businesses need to be doing, looking at the state of the world at the moment. Jackie, what advice do you have for young people who might be listening, who might not even know where to start or, you know, in terms of getting on boards based on your experience and getting into corporate leadership based on your experience?
Yeah, I think it's about really look for every opportunity you can. And that might be volunteering. I'd say get a good mentor. I think all through my career, having a good mentor, not necessarily a coach, but a mentor who you can trust, who will tell you when you're not being brave enough, or if you're too brave and you're not being respectful enough. And that can help guide you through many, many of your decisions in life.
Thank you so much, Jackie. That's all I had to ask you today. You've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Cliff. Really enjoyed it.
I'm now joined by my co-host, Sonia Maria, while Donna Bridges is away this week. Sonia, that was a very packed two interviews. What are your thoughts?
I had a couple of really interesting sort of light bulb moments when you were talking to your guests. The first one was really about how to avoid tokenism and what does tokenism actually mean. And I had been thinking a lot about this in my organisations that I've previously worked in, because it's quite a novelty still to see women in leadership roles at the lower levels of leadership, certainly, but definitely not the higher levels. So that was the first one. And the second one was the comment that was made, if you can't see anyone who looks like you or has similar interests, then maybe you're not in the right company. I thought that one was a doozy too. So both of those I thought were great talking points.
Definitely. I think the notion of tokenism is perhaps really interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes it really is about what is the organization doing beside just hiring women. That's one way. But just having a presence doesn't change anything. It's really how is the organization creating a mechanism for women to thrive and to grow, both professionally and personally, as opposed to them having to leave their lives at the door when they walk in.
I think so too, Cliff. And I look at my own paramedic background, and we know that in the last few years, we've reached equal numbers of women and men working in the services. We still haven't got a great work environment for women to be in there, though. So even though the numbers are the same, it hasn't really changed much in the last 10 or 20 years. We're still facing the same issues and with work-shift-life balance that we had 20 years ago. And some of those are because of the traditional culture that paramedicine has, but also a lot of that is just this ingrained, hidden culture that just keeps on perpetuating itself too, because it was and still is a male-dominated industry.
And that just illustrates how changing policy or legislation is one thing, but without the social change, really it all falls apart. But you made another interesting observation about, you know, if you don't see someone like you represented, you're not in the right company. What sparked your interest on that one, Sonia?
Yes, I think that for me personally, when I entered the services in paramedicine, there was a few women, but certainly there wasn't a lot of women. And if I had been looking for women role models, I would have struggled at that point. I think it's a cliche statement, like it probably does work for a lot of people, but there's certainly a lot of industries where there are few women, where women still like to work, like myself and other women now in paramedicine. And so the higher up I go in management structures, the less role models I have. And so you become a bit of a trailblazer, but it is a very difficult path and it's quite stressful because you are torn by replicating male behaviours or being a female in leadership.
And that's such a false binary, isn't it? Like, as opposed to just being yourself in leadership. But having said that, there's also this idea that sometimes you are in a position where you're trailblazing so others can then follow. And, you know, channeling Julia Gillard there, who said, I'm the first prime minister, but there'll be others after me who are female as well. You know, so there is that role to be able to leverage the privilege we have, whatever it is, or we've earned, to be able to support others getting up.
I think you can, when you do get into leadership roles, it does give you an opportunity to look back and reflect on the things, and you do have an insight into the things that made it harder, and you are able to influence and make things easier.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sonia. And thank you to all our listeners. We'll catch you again next month, same place and same time.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.